Well, welcome, ladies and gentlemen, to a webinar, my very first webinar. So you're part of a historic occasion for me, and I have no idea how well this is going to work out. Everybody who knows me understands that I'm a very low-tech guy, and I've never used this kind of setup before. So there's a good chance that I'll foul it up, but. Thank goodness Danny is standing by to come to my rescue if that happens. And so I'm just going to get started and proceed as well as I can with this technology. And I hope that this is working out for you. And I will speak for a while just as if I were giving you a lecture or a formal presentation. I hope no more than 45 minutes. And at that time, we'll switch over to my answering your questions, which I expect I'll be able to find here at the side of my screen when the time comes. So let's begin. The topic today is the Great Depression and the present crisis. And this comparison has been one that a great many people have been making for the past several years, almost as soon as the financial crisis of the fall, late summer and fall of 2008 took place. Many people began to look back to the 1929 stock market crash and the subsequent events of the Great Depression. And the current recession has persisted, those kinds of comparisons have if anything, have become even more common, and a great many people have used this what we find there is that there have been many booms and busts, but the recoveries from busts have usually been quite quick and complete. Normally, a business cycle contraction that's worthy of the name will be followed by a recovery within a year or two. So that 2 years after the bottom of the trough, the economy is usually operating again at a level comparable to the prosperity it enjoyed before the preceding bust. So there have been many booms and busts, but prolonged recoveries have been quite unusual, and the two that come most to mind for the economic historian are the long drawn out recovery of the 1890s, although it was a little confused by almost looking like a little sub event in the middle of it. But from 1893, the economy became depressed, and it didn't fully recover until about 5 years later, which was an unusually long time. So that was one exception to the rule that recoveries are usually pretty short. The other, of course, was the Great Depression of the 1930s, from which recovery was never full when World War II started. And then, although most people say the war ended the Depression, I argue that it only changed the form of the Depression to one of war-related deprivation of consumers and investors in order to steer resources to war purposes. So in my view, that depression didn't actually end until 1946. But regardless of whether you take my view or the orthodox view, it was an extraordinarily long drawn out recovery with a major setback in 1937-38. So there have been exceptions, and the current recession is now looking as if it's going to take much longer for recovery than any other post-war recession has taken. So we've got two exceptions, and three if we count the current situation. But normally recoveries have occurred fairly quickly. Now, one of the other points that's important to understand is that in analyzing business cycles, we can mislead ourselves very easily by using aggregate analysis. And unfortunately, aggregate analysis is the type of analysis that the economics profession, for the most part, has used to study business cycles ever since the 1930s. The Keynesian Revolution was a revolution moving from a disaggregated, more microeconomic way of thinking about booms and busts to thinking about them in terms of aggregates such as national income or product, the rate of unemployment for the whole labor force, the total volume of investment spending or consumption spending, or government spending, and so forth. So these broad aggregates that purport to measure some volume of expenditure or economic activity for the whole activity, for the whole economy, have come to be the lingo in which macroeconomists speak about business cycles. But when we do that, we lose sight of the economic structure, that is the fact that the economy does not produce a single blob of output, as we might think in a macro model. We have something here usually called real output, as if it were a single measurable variable. But in fact, of course, the economy produces countless discrete types of outputs using countless types of technology to do so, and consists of many different industries and types of production, a vast assortment of different kinds of resources, including different types of labor services, and so forth, so that the economy has an intricate structure. And what a disaggregated analysis of booms and busts requires us to do is to pay attention to that structure and to take note of how during the boom it becomes distorted in some way. It becomes configured in a form that is not sustainable, and so it's planted with the seeds of its own destruction in the course of a boom, particularly a boom that is induced by some type of government intervention, such as central bank manipulation of interest rates. So that if we think in terms of aggregates, if we disregard the economy's structure, we don't understand what's happening during the boom. It may appear indeed as if all is well, when in fact all is not well at all. And then when the bust takes place, we will have a better understanding of what must be done in order for the economy to recover, which is to say it has to be restructured. It has to take this distorted structure somehow and alter it back into a form that allows for sustained economic growth, so that if we've had a distortion, which is quite common during the boom of applying more resources for the production of long-term capital goods than can be sustained, then what will happen during the bust is that in order to clear out those malinvestments, we have to shut down some forms of production. We have to reallocate labor and capital services, and we have to move resources around so that they're no longer put in a place that they can't remain indefinitely. So that this restructuring takes place in a free market system through the operation of the price system. That is to say, the way we stop doing some of the things that we were doing too much of during the boom is that the entrepreneurs in these activities will find they're losing money, that their operations are causing them to incur losses, and as a result, they will eventually decide that they should simply shut this down, liquidate it, redirect any resources they've been using that still have value to new uses where they have genuine value in the present circumstances. So the price system, the system of profit and loss, is, if left to itself, capable of giving people signals as to what they need to do to correct the mistakes that have been made on a wide scale during the boom. If the government intervenes during the recovery process by blocking or distorting the operation of the price system, then what it's doing, in effect, is sending false signals to entrepreneurs about what activities are viable in the new circumstances. So the government intervening to save existing firms, which is very common since the owners and operators of existing firms often have political influence, and if the government pays heed to their pleas for salvation, then the government may in one way or another attempt to keep them going, even though economic realities dictate that they be closed down and their resources reallocated. So if we have government intervention on a wide scale or in certain important forms, then what will happen is that the necessary restructuring to correct the malinvestments and distortions built up during the boom will not take place. And we may get a kind of momentary apparent recovery because the government is spending a lot of money and putting people on its own payroll or spending money for products of privileged firms, subsidized firms, and creating a kind of artificial recovery in that way. But obviously what's happening in that case is that we're not reallocating resources in a way that's consistent with ultimately with what consumers want to do with their own expenditures. So these are the kinds of preliminaries we need to bear in mind as we begin to look at these two particular episodes of drawn-out recovery in the 1930s and in the past few years. Let's, if I can move my display, hooray, I've mastered one step here. Let's look at the lead-up to these two busts and see how they compare. First of all, in terms of monetary policy, which is perhaps the most important thing to check, and what we find is that during the mid-1920s, the Federal Reserve System, which as of 1923 had only been operating for a decade, and during much of that time it had steered its operations toward assisting the Treasury and financing World War I, the Fed brought about easy money conditions, especially from 1923 to 1928, through open market operations, through buying government securities and therefore injecting funds into the commercial banking system, and making interest rates lower than they otherwise would have been. And the Fed did this for several reasons, but perhaps the most important one at that time was that Great Britain and some other countries that had gone off the gold standard during World War I were attempting to return to the gold standard. But when the British did so in 1926, they did that at an exchange rate that disregarded the true market value of the pound sterling, attempted to price it at $4.86 in dollar terms. And that was the old pre-war parity that the gold standard had accommodated between pound sterling and U.S. dollars. But the pound sterling had lost a great deal of purchasing power as a result of expansions of the British money supply during World War I. And as of the mid-1920s, it still needed to contract in order to make the exchange value the same as it had been with dollars before the war. So what happened is that the English got themselves into a situation where their currency was overpriced when they went back on the gold standard, and therefore their export industries were unable to operate at a very high level. And Britain relied in those days on selling a lot of exports to earn income. And so industries such as shipbuilding, textiles, chemicals, other industries where the British had established a strong position in international trade were not doing well because of the bad choice of exchange rate when the British went back on the gold standard. Well, in order to help the British do better, the monetary authorities in the United States, particularly Benjamin Strong, who was the most important figure, he was the head of the New York Federal Reserve Bank at that time, and was a good friend of Montague Norman, the head of the Bank of England. Strong persuaded other central bankers. The Fed was still somewhat decentralized in those days. He persuaded the people at other Federal Reserve banks to go along with him in creating easy money policy in the mid-20s and especially in 1927. So interest rates were being kept lower in the United States as a result than they would have been without this intervention. One effect of that was to create some malinvestments, and especially notable were those in the construction industry. And the United States experienced a huge boom in real estate and construction, especially between 1921 and 1926. The boom did peak about 1926, but it didn't crash exactly. It just backed off a little bit, and there was still a high level of construction activity in the United States, especially in building office buildings and skyscrapers in big cities up until 1929. So the boom peaked in 26, but real estate remained pretty strong even in the next 3 years. Another artifact of having easy money was that a lot of financial gimmicks looked like good deals for people looking to get rich. And in this real estate boom, for example, entrepreneurs cooked up real estate bonds as a means of financing developments. What this meant was that they would issue securities, bonds whose collateral consisted of the very developments they were being sold to finance. So this is a pretty iffy operation. It was almost as if the hope and the prayer of these real estate developers was their collateral, whereas they didn't have any really good collateral behind these bonds. And later on, many of these bonds became almost worthless, or in some cases, actually worthless. Another device used extensively in the 1920s was holding companies for stocks. Holding companies were not innovations. They'd been around for decades, but their use expanded greatly in the 1920s. Holding companies are companies that buy the shares of operating companies, and then you can keep going. You can have another holding company that buys the shares of holding companies, and so on. And you can pyramid these holding companies. And the reason why you might want to do that, and why people did do it in the 1920s, is that you don't have to buy all the shares of an operating company to control it. 51% is always enough, and very often in practice, a much smaller part of the shares will allow the holders of that minority share to control the company. So what was being done is that people were investing in higher level holding companies as a way of controlling a lot of value on the ground while placing a relatively small amount of their own capital at risk. And you don't have to think too hard about how this works to see that if stock values are rising, this is great. The more leveraged you are, the higher you are in the holding company pyramid, the higher the return on your actual investment. But the risk is that if share values begin to fall, then the whole thing works in reverse, and the more leveraged holding companies get completely wiped out by relatively small movements in the share values of the companies lower in the pyramid. So that did happen. A great many of those holding companies that had been making money hand over fist for people in the mid-1920s became utterly worthless in the early 1930s, and many of them were just simply liquidated. They weren't worth anything. Okay, so these are the kinds of things that we see during the boom. They're typical of boom periods. They were exaggerated during the 1920s, however. Now, we see some comparable things in the current crisis. We see, particularly between 2002 and 2005, a period of easy money. And this was brought about by Federal Reserve actions using open market policy to make bank reserves increase fairly rapidly, and therefore put banks in a position to lend more and thereby increase the money stock in the form of demand deposits created in connection with loans they extend. So easy money prevailed from 2002 to 2005. This was the Fed's way of, as it were, trying to fix the bust of 2001, the so-called dot-com bust or tech bust that had followed the run-up of a lot of tech companies, internet-related companies that had begun in the late 1990s. So the Fed had overreacted to that 2001 recession and pushed the federal funds rate down to 1% at the bottom there, and very low for the whole period I've indicated there from 2002 to 2005. And if we look at the whole period from the end of the year 2000 to the end of 2006, what we see is that the money stock in the M2 definition grew by 2.5 to 3 times as much as the real gross national product was growing. So money was really running away from real output in that period. And the result, of course, was to provoke malinvestments, as usual. Distorted interest rates make long-term investments look more profitable than they otherwise would appear. And in the recent episode, of course, we saw a tremendous boom in real estate of all kinds, especially residential real estate in certain parts of the country, the West Coast, Florida in particular, and in construction, with lots of houses being built. And of course, we had other government policies that were acting in the same direction, particularly the government's efforts to make credit available to house buyers who otherwise wouldn't have qualified for mortgage loans, via using Fannie and Freddie in particular to provide a secondary market for these iffy mortgages that the banks and other lenders were extending to the house buyers, and then the initial lenders were then immediately reselling to Fannie or Freddie or some other purchaser in the secondary market. But by 2007, Fannie and Freddie themselves alone held about half, or held or guaranteed about half of all the mortgage loans outstanding in the United States. So this was a very exaggerated event. During this same time, we saw the usual financial gimmicks. We have a lot of securitization going on, mortgage-related securities of all kinds. And again, these securities being pyramided upward as one kind of derivative would be created, and then it would be marketed, and somebody would package those derivatives and market them, and you could pile this up again just the way you piled up holding companies back in the 1920s. We had something called credit default swaps that, again, were not new. They had been around for more than a decade, but credit default swaps really came into their own after about 2002 and assumed huge dimensions. They were a way of insuring against default on securities, but not using insurance policies to do so, because if you use insurance policies, you subject yourself to all the requirements of the laws that regulate insurance. But credit default swaps are de facto insurance policies, and a great many of them were bought and sold in the period running up to the financial debacle in 2008. So these are the sorts of things that were going on in the two episodes. They have a lot of similarities. The specifics are different, but the substance was quite similar. Now, when the bust occurred, in 1929, it began actually about the middle of the year. It didn't occur rapidly. There was a peak about the middle of the year, and real output began to decline a little bit, but not very quickly in the beginning. In October, late October of 1929, the stock market crashed and it took a severe beating in just a few weeks. Between late October and mid-November, lost most of its value before that panic, just in a few weeks' time. After that, however, the stock market turned around, and from mid-November for about the next 4 or 5 months into the spring of 1930, stock prices rebounded quite substantially, and that became known as the Sucker's Rally. For obvious reasons, because if you thought all was well at that point, you got back into the market, you were just putting yourself in position to really lose a lot of money, because from about April 1930 on, the market began to turn down again, and except for very short-lived reversals, it continued down until the latter part of 1932. And by that time, stock markets had lost more than 80% of the value they had before the 1929 crash. So the stock market took a gigantic beating in the early 1930s. The economy's overall output, as measured by gross domestic product, continued to fall all the way from mid-1929 to the spring of 1933, and as a result, it declined by about 30%. There's never been a contraction comparable to that, or even close to that, in U.S. economic history. So there's a reason we call it the Great Depression, and that part of it, the Great Contraction. In the current crisis, the peak was reached for real output in the winter of 2007, early 2008, and then the decline continued for about five quarters or perhaps a little more. The latest revisions in the data actually show a peak in the last quarter of 2007 and a trough in the second quarter of 2009. So there it looks as if the contraction runs about a year and a half. Originally, the data made it look as if it was more like a year. But it didn't fall very much early in 2008, and it fell very rapidly in the last part of 2008 and the beginning of 2009. Since then, there's been some recovery, so that real GDP is pretty much back where it was before this 5% drop. There was, of course, a financial panic and debacle in the latter part of September 2008, running into October, and to some extent running for several months afterwards. A great many financial markets were described as having frozen or imploded or blown up or disappeared. All kinds of wild metaphors were tossed around about what had happened to credit markets in the fall of 2008. In many cases, they were simply gigantic exaggerations. But there have been severe disruptions, and particularly the shadow credit market, which is where people have been borrowing by selling securities and derivatives of various kinds. So that part of the credit market did, in fact, experience a real crisis in late 2008. The normal bank lending showed much less severe problems in late 2008. In fact, for a long time, it didn't look as if bank lending was contracting at all. It was only later that signs of that contraction showed up in 2009. Again, we may have had a sucker's rally in the stock market after stocks had gone down a great deal to hit a bottom in February 2009. They generally trended upward after that, running up into this year in the summer. In July, they seem to have at least momentarily peaked. They've come down 10 or 15% since then, but they're still much above their low in early 2009. So again, we've got some similarities here, but one thing I want to emphasize is that the severity in terms of real output losses in the current recession are in no way comparable to what happened during the Great Depression. We can see some other interesting aspects of these events. Here I've got a graph in which gross domestic product is shown in the solid line, and that line shows you, these are in logarithms for some purpose I had at the time, but what it shows you is that steady decline from 1929 to 1933, and then a pretty steady recovery. It doesn't recover all the way, And it certainly does not get back to its trend rate, which is the top straight line with the tiny dots making it up at the top of the drawing. That's the long-term trend rate of growth that we can estimate the economy had the ability to follow if it had continued to use its resources fully throughout those years. But even in 1937, when the economy is getting close to its 1929 level of real GDP, it's still far below where it would have been if it had stayed on its growth trend. And it then falls back in 1938 before resuming a recovery. And you see in this representation, it appears to have recovered fully in 1941, when it's back to its trend level. And then in a very misleading fashion, it rises way above the trend during World War II. I won't speak about that today, but that's a statistical artifact. One shouldn't take that seriously. On the other hand, if you look just at the private part of gross domestic product, what you see in the 1930s in the bars is that severe decline to 1933, some fairly rapid recovery to 37, that secondary depression, and then in 1939 the economy is back to its 37 level and continues to recover through 1941. But here what you'll notice is that for the private economy, even in 1941, it had not recovered fully because its growth trend, which is in the straight dashed line, is still far above where the private output of the economy was in 1941. So private recovery was never complete before the war began, and then it the private economy was suppressed during the war, as you see there, but I'm not going to talk about that right now. In the current episode, we have real GDP declining here from that winter of 2007, early 2008, and you see it drop, and then you see it recover, so that it's back about to where it was at its old peak by the middle of this year. That's the last measure I have there in the graph. So, as I said before, if you look at the scale over there of what the magnitudes are, what you see is that we're looking at a 5% dip here rather than the 30% dip of the Great Depression. Another way to get a handle on what happened during the Great Depression is by looking at hours worked. And in an article of mine published a few years ago in a journal called Libertarian Papers, I organized some of these data. This helps us to avoid some of the problems associated with defining the rate of unemployment in the 1930s. There's a lot of debate about how it should be measured, and we can avoid that debate altogether by looking not at unemployment, but by looking at employment, and better yet, looking at actual hours worked. And in this table, I've divided that into several classifications, depending on whether it's government or private, military or civilian, farm or non-farm. And what you see there is that there's a tremendous reduction in hours worked, and the most important part of that is shown in this graph, which is the private non-farm hours worked. Farmers don't alter their hours very much in the Depression. They keep producing, and the Depression for them takes the form of low prices for their products. But in the non-farm economy, depressions are associated with reductions in employment. And here what you see is a steep reduction of about 30% in private non-farm hours worked between 1929 and 1932. And then I want you to notice particularly that the recovery you see here is much less brisk than the one you see in the gross domestic product chart I showed you earlier. That made it look as if you had a pretty rapid recovery, and by 1937 you were almost back to the 1929 level of real output. But here what you see is that the Depression actually has a long flat bottom. The years 32, 33, and 34 are really not very different in terms of the depressed level of private hours worked. One of the things that we avoid here is being fooled by the fact that a lot of employment in 1933, 4, 5 was reduced hours employment, so that even when people had a job then, they were often working fewer hours than they wanted to work, and fewer hours than they normally would work in an economy with a high level of employment. In those days, a full work week would have been 45 to 50 hours, but we had a lot of people working in the 1933 or years working maybe only 25 or 30 hours a week, if that much. So that's taken into account in these data here, because we see only the hours actually worked by non-farm workers. And what you see here is that in 1937, the economy is still about 15% below the hours worked in 1929. And then it falls again in 38 and has to resume its recovery. And it's not until 1941 that private non-farm hours work gets back to approximately the level of 1929. But remember, during this 12-year period, the labor force has grown quite a bit. It's somewhere between 10 and 15% bigger in 1941 than it had been in 1929. So the fact that you've got back to the hours worked of 12 years earlier is no great triumph. You've still got a lot of people who want to work more hours and are not working. So this is a thing to bear in mind. Now, more recently here, we've got an unemployment rate that jumps up to 10% at one point in 2009. And doesn't come down much afterwards. It's stuck now at about twice where it was during the boom years, and it's come down slightly, maybe one percentage point, but not very much. And again, if we look at private hours worked, in this chart we see an index of aggregate weekly hours of private employees as an aggregate. And what we see there is an approximately 10% drop, with a little bit of recovery, so that maybe if we look at the level of hours worked since the middle of 2009, we're seeing it's still about 10% below where it was during the boom years of 6, 7, and into the middle of 2008. So we see a lot of ways in which, again, we've got similarities here, but again, differences in magnitudes, because this depression is not nearly as severe as the one in the 1930s. Now, in both cases, the government has taken a lot of action. And I find that I'm going too slow in this presentation, so I'm going to have to rush through a recitation of what the government did. But many of these things will be familiar to you anyhow. Under the Hoover administration, the government intervened to try to get employers to not reduce wages. And as a result, in the industrial part of the economy, real wages actually rose in the early 1930s. That's really wonderful. if you've got the demand for labor falling rapidly and you raise the real wage rate on top of it, you will not guarantee a very large increase in unemployment. And that's what we saw, especially in the industrial economy in the early 30s. There was also a big increase in tariffs in 1930, the Smoot-Hawley Tariff Act. The government created the Reconstruction Finance Corporation in 1932 to prop up big banks and insurance companies and railroads and farm cooperatives and other established incumbent firms that had political influence at the time. And this is very reminiscent of things that have been done in the last 3 years as well. So there was nothing new about the kind of bailouts we saw in 2008 and 9 and 10, because the Hoover administration was doing the same kinds of things in the early 30s. Taxes were raised enormously, especially in the Revenue Act of 1932. And again, that's just what you want in a deep depression, right? To raise people's taxes. And of course, when Roosevelt was elected and the New Deal was instituted, these kinds of interventions were increased by order of magnitude, really. A lot of times people want to emphasize the similarity between the Hoover administration and the New Deal, and there are many similarities, and it's certainly not at all the case that Hoover was some kind of a free marketeer, anything but. But the New Deal was on a completely different scale. It had important kinds of interventions going on almost everywhere in the economy. For example, the National Industrial Recovery Act, enacted in the spring of 1933, was an attempt to cartelize the entire industrial economy and eventually put into force some 700 plus so-called codes of fair competition, which were cartel agreements, each one tailored to the specific circumstances of an industry. In agriculture, the government passed the Agricultural Adjustment Act, attempting a semi-cartelization of many aspects of agriculture as well, particularly staple crops, cotton, wheat, corn, and so forth. In the current crisis, we've seen, starting with the Bush administration's actions, especially from the middle of 2008, a lot of bailouts, attempts to provide stimulus to consumer spending. I didn't mention the Fed actions in the Great Depression, but at that time the Fed's principal action was to try a little bit to increase the money stock at the same time it was falling, because people were switching from demand deposits to cash, and banks were switching to higher levels of reserves being held. But the Fed's actions were far from enough to offset those bank and public actions, and as a result, the money stock declined by over 30% during the early 1930s. Recently, of course, the Fed has taken gigantic expansionary actions, and I'll say a little more about that in a moment. All of these bailouts, takeovers of the General Motors and Chrysler and AIG and Fannie and Freddie have been giant deals. These are not small potatoes operations in the last 3 years, nor have these stimulus bills been small deals. The one enacted soon after President Obama took office is estimated in the neighborhood, depending on which estimate you credit. They move around from time to time as the money works its way through the system, but it's in the neighborhood of $800 billion for that one stimulus bill alone. And of course, the Fed has had two rounds of so-called quantitative easing, the first one to basically buy a lot of mortgage-related securities from Fannie, Freddie, and banks and other holders, and the second one basically to finance the federal treasury. But we've got all of these things happening. Here's a depiction of what happened to the monetary base as a result of the Fed's recent actions. The monetary base was doubled in a period of about 4 months. And as you can see, historically, the monetary base always grew slowly and smoothly. There's almost never anything you can even see as a blip in that curve. And yet, when you get to September 2008, what you see is something like an ICBM blasting off. And there's no precedent whatsoever, no precedent for anything at all like this in U.S. economic history. And many people feared, and some still fear, that the consequence of that will be a great acceleration of price inflation. It hasn't happened in any significant way yet, because the banks have simply absorbed the excess reserves and held them rather than lending them out or using them to make new investments. But they have the ability to greatly extend their operations whenever they feel safe in doing so. So far, they've been concerned with rebuilding their balance sheets, and also it's the case that the lenders that are creditworthy right now are not clamoring to borrow. Many big corporations are themselves sitting on huge cash accumulations, and so they're not potential customers for bank loans. And that, along with the bank's reticence, has given us the situation that we're in. There's been a lot of ebb and flow associated with the government's actions. Back in the 30s, every crackpot you can imagine came out of the woodwork with a plan, and many of these were put into operation by the government. There was a lot of attempt to try something, which meant, as I indicate here, a lot of picking losers, a lot of propping up firms and industries that should have been contracting or liquidating and keeping them alive. And in particular, the Roosevelt administration did go on the warpath against investors and continued on the warpath through the rest of the decade. Actually, the administration became, if anything, even more hostile toward investors as a class, and to some extent business people as a class, after 1935. The result of all this New Deal action, and before that, the Hoover administration action, was that the United States moved from a highly market-oriented economy to a sort of fascism, not the fascism of Germany or Italy or Spain or other countries that adopted fascism in the interwar period, but a homegrown fascism in which the government became deeply involved and insinuated into the operation of many different industries, firms, and types of economic activity. And we've had that kind of economy ever since. I call it participatory fascism because you're still allowed to go cast a vote in political elections. It's not the fascism of Germany after Hitler took over, but it's economic fascism. In the current crisis, we've had a reversion to what I call vulgar Keynesianism as a remedy, and this means that there's been a lot of emphasis on increasing government spending to make up for the shortfall of private spending. This is the 60-year-old Keynesian model that's being evoked here. In this case, there's a lot of trying something, all right, but in this case, it's not so much picking losers as in many cases, especially in the financial bailouts, it's been picking winners. the big winners in a lot of these bailouts have been the big boys, especially the big boys on Wall Street. Many of the big banks were probably bankrupt and should have been liquidated, but thanks to their friends at the Federal Reserve System, they've been able to continue operating, and they haven't ever been required to make up their accounts in a way that reveals their actual situation. So that my strong suspicion, and other people's strong suspicion as well, is that many of the banks operating now are zombies, that they're actually broke, but their accounts don't show it yet. A lot of investors have been paid off in this case for their losses. They've been made good by the government, and as a result, the level of moral hazard has been increased enormously. People learn from these experiences to expect bailouts, and to some extent, they were already expecting that. That's how we got the Freddie Fannie situation in the decade after 2001. So that what we have now is not that we've constructed fascism as a result of all these interventions, but that we've entrenched the economic fascism that already existed. In the process of all this flailing about, the government creates a great deal of what I call the regime uncertainty. That is, it makes investors afraid that their private property rights in their capital and in the income their capital yields may be taken away from them. They really don't know what regulators will do, what the government will do in terms of its fiscal policy, its taxation. They don't even know about outright seizures, because in some cases the government has actually seized property. Most notably, of course, the Roosevelt administration seized all of the monetary gold in the economy. This economy had always used gold for monetary purposes. It was outlawed in 1933, and the government seized it and put strong criminal penalties on people who retained any of their gold money, or, you know, whether in coins, or bars, or gold certificates. And so the seizures are not out of the question at all. So that has to be borne in mind by investors. In the current crisis, we've had a somewhat lower amount of regime uncertainty, I think, because the economic order itself is not up for grabs. I think there's no real prospect of the system of economic fascism being anything else in the foreseeable future. But nonetheless, there has been a great deal of uncertainty associated with major policies, particularly tax policies, regulatory policies in the environmental area and other areas, Obamacare, which affects the cost of health care benefits for employers who provide those benefits, and of course the Financial Reform Act. Both Obamacare and the Dodd-Frank Act open up the requirement of hundreds of different forms of new regulations to be formed. And until those have been formulated, and until the victims discover how they're going to be shaped and enforced, it's very risky to undertake hiring permanent new employees or making long-term investments. So many people have been reluctant to do both of those things, and that's why the current lack of recovery taking the form it's taken. So I've talked longer than I wanted to. I've talked about an hour, but we still have plenty of time for your questions. And so if I can find your questions here, I'm going to see if I can respond to them.
Thank you for that wonderful lecture, Dr. Higgs. If you like, I could read the questions out loud for you, and also because the students can't what we can see.
Okay, I have them now, Danny.
Great. Is it okay if I read them out loud for you?
Well, I can read them here as I answer them. Joshua Koch has a question. I have read your book, Against Leviathan, and it was a great piece of work. I wonder if you can tell me how you would change the current economy. Well, Joshua, that would take a long time to explain. Basically, what I would do would be to get rid of practically every form of government involvement that exists. So there would be a lot of work cut out for me if I was going to make reforms. I'd rather not make reforms. I'd rather just abolish the government root and branch. But at all events, if I had to have some kind of government, I'd want to clean out a lot of the accumulations of regulation and government spending programs of various sorts that have built up over the past century or more. I believe that virtually all of these government involvements in the economy reduce the welfare of consumers and of most producers, for that matter. So it's very difficult for anybody to find a form of government intervention in the economy that I'm willing to approve. Let me look up here to the next question. I'm in the wrong menu here. I got it now. Okay. Benjamin Zwicky, I'm not sure I'm pronouncing it right, but Benjamin says, do you think we will have to go through a depression before the current crisis is over? I don't think we have to. That doesn't mean we won't. I don't myself think that the probability of repeating something as severe as the Great Depression of the 1930s is high, but I wouldn't say the probability is zero. My best guess, and I don't want to represent it as anything more than my best guess, because I'm not a prophet. In fact, I think anybody who gives you firm forecasts about things like this is fooling himself or you or both of you. But my best guess is that we're in for a long period of stagflation. And that is to say, I don't think we're going to have much real recovery. I wouldn't be surprised if we had many years of relatively high unemployment. I don't know if it'll remain at 9 or 10%. Maybe that can be brought down a little bit, but it might actually be higher at some point in the next few years. I don't see it going too far away from where it is now in either direction. But I don't see any reason to expect the economy to grow in real terms very quickly either. I think the risk of accelerating inflation remains, and the Federal Reserve System's plan, if you want to dignify it with that description, its plan for backing away from everything it's done in the past 3 years and going back to something like the old pre-crisis normal, I'm very doubtful will work. I think the Fed has painted itself into a corner, and I also think that it's acquired some new powers that it really won't want to give up. I think the Fed has now become the central credit allocator for the U.S. economy, and I don't think it's going to want to forego that tremendous power. So it's hard to know what the Fed is going to do. I will hazard the guess that it's going to continue to accommodate the government's need for financing its big deficits. I don't think there's any question that the government will continue to run huge deficits for many years. Even the government's own forecasts show that. And I suspect that things will be worse than the government's forecast. Steve Fritzinger asks a question. For unemployment numbers in the 30s, do these numbers count people working on public relief jobs like WPA, CCC as employed or unemployed? Steve, it depends on which unemployment series you look at, whether those people are counted or not. the official Labor Department unemployment numbers do not count people on emergency government employment programs as employed. It counts them as unemployed. And that's how you get, for example, an unemployment rate in 1940 of about 15%. Whereas if you take away all of those people who are counted as unemployed by the Labor Department, but were actually employed by the WPA or the CCC or the NYA or some other government make-work operation, the unemployment rate in 1940 is more like 10%. So about 4 or 5% of the labor force during the Roosevelt administration's first two terms is being counted as unemployed by the official unemployment rate, but they're not actually without jobs. That part of the unemployed have make work employment. Okay, Mike Eisenstein, I'm not sure I got the whole last name there. Mike Eisenstein, is what I see on my screen, asks, with no end to market interventions, distortions, manipulations in sight, does the U.S. go the route of Japan and suffer economic deflation, Soviet Union and collapse economically, or Weimar and experience rapid inflation as the government continues to intervene? Mike, I think I, in a way, answered that question a few minutes ago. I think the interventions will continue. They'll continue to be problems. They'll continue to stand in the way of real recovery, and so I think the current situation bids fair to remain more or less what it is for years on end. As I said, we may start to see some accelerating inflation before long, but that really depends on whether the Fed succeeds in blocking the effects of renewed bank lending in the event that the banks actually start to lend seriously again to increase their lending. So that's my best guess right now. It's a kind of stagflation, stagnation, more like Japan. I don't see a Soviet Union implosion in our future, and I don't see a Weimar hyperinflation either. So I would rule out those extremes. Next question is from Hansen. He says, you talked about GDP and its relation to trend growth. In my view, GDP is essentially GDC, gross domestic consumption. We cannot assume the old trend to be sustainable as money expansion will lead society into consuming out of its capital. Well, We first have to see, Hans, what actually happens to money and prices in the future. We've got this unprecedented situation now where the banks are stuffed full of over $1 trillion worth of legally excess reserves, but they're not using those reserves in a way that brings about a rapid run-up of money stock and therefore a rapid run-up of prices in general. There has been some price run-up in parts of the economy, particularly in commodity markets and raw materials in the last few years. These things are not captured in the usual price indexes for consumers, of course, but and of course there's been this stock run-up I mentioned earlier. So the effect of having some additional bank capacity to lend may have squeezed itself into those outlets for the last couple of years rather than into the form of running up any of the standard measures of money and therefore prices. But again, I think everything hinges on how the behavior of the money stock and prices play out in the next few years. And I don't know. I don't think anybody really knows, and I think we're going to have to wait and see. Next question is from Matthew Gessner. Why are banks currently reluctant to loan if they're sitting on a massive amount of funds? Well, I touched on that earlier. That is to say, in part, they're still rebuilding their own reserves. They're rebuilding their balance sheets and putting themselves in a position where they don't have to be so afraid of their shaky situation being revealed. They're also in a situation where the people that might want to borrow from them are not creditworthy, and the people that are creditworthy are not wanting to borrow from them. So the situation in the bank lending market here is a product both of the demand side and of the supply side of that loanable funds market. Dennis Marburger says, what do we see when we examine the velocity of money during these time frames? Well, what we see back in the Great Contraction, Dennis, is that the monetary velocity fell quite a lot. That's what I meant when I spoke before about the public's desire to exchange demand deposits in banks for cash. That causes a reduction in the money multiplier, and so what we had in the early 30s was a fall in velocity. We've had a similar fall, but much less in magnitude recently. Again, people have accumulated cash more than they had been before this crisis, so that there's been some decline, but not anything like the decline in velocity that we saw in the early 30s. Thomas Frederick Hansen says, many commentators believe the Fed will do a new operation twist next week. What can be the rationale behind this when the 10-year yield is around 2%? In my view, they try to signal that the balance sheet will remain elevated for a long time. I think what they're trying to do, Hans, is actually to bring about a revival of housing construction. I'm laughing because I think that's a bizarre thing to be doing. The crisis we're in now, although it has many contributing factors, has above all a bubble in real estate and housing. And that, of course, hinged on monetary accommodation by the Fed and government measures through Fannie Freddie and regulations and all the rest of it to promote loans to borrowers on mortgage loans that weren't creditworthy. But at all events, the upshot is that we had a housing bubble, and now it's busted. In many parts of the country, house prices have fallen by 50% or more. They're sort of stuck down there right now in most places at whatever low level they fell to. But the level of construction activity is very depressed, and I really believe that the Fed thinks if they can get long-term interest rates down, it will encourage people to buy, and therefore encourage house builders to build new housing. There are several million units vacant right now, unable to find buyers in this country, and so to me, this just seems like a goofy thing to do. It's possible that it's also aimed at helping the federal government. As I said before, QE2 was pretty much entirely an accommodation of the government's deficit. And QE3, if it happens, if Operation Twist takes place, may be aimed in the same direction, because the government does use long-term bonds to finance a lot of its deficit spending. I don't know, though. I'm not privy to what goes on at the meetings of the Federal Reserve Open Market Committee, so I'm taking my best guess there. Mike Eisenstein says, the government has amassed massive amounts of debt trying to prop up the fiat money system since 1971. At what point do the markets, which are largely driven and controlled by the banks, that is the treasury market, surrender their belief in the system? Mike, I don't know what that point is, when it will come, if ever. I don't think we're actually approaching it at the moment. I think a great deal can still be done to prop up the existing system. I'm not one who thinks the whole monetary system or the dollar is just about to collapse. In fact, I'm not even sure what people mean when they use that language. What do they think is going to happen? Suddenly, 300 million Americans are not going to any longer use dollars to make purchases. What would they use instead? The economy couldn't operate if people suddenly gave up using dollars. So I don't foresee any collapse of the dollar. Of course, the dollar may lose a lot of its purchasing power. As I said, we may have accelerating price inflation. Of course, there are still very powerful financial actors making up the upper echelons of the financial system with a great influence with the Fed. So the Fed and the Treasury are certainly going to work hand in hand with the big banking actors and other big financial institutions to save the current system. Of course, they're changing it in a variety of ways. They instituted through Dodd-Frank provisions for monitoring systemic risk and for imposing all kinds of new regulations on financial institutions. They've instituted a number of changes that purport to move in the direction of making the existing system less fragile. I don't know whether any of these things will have the desired effect or not. I suspect that they're mostly ill-constructed or counterproductive, but a great deal of that activity is going on right now, and so we'll just have to see what effects it has. I'm not expecting any imminent collapse of the existing financial system, however. Steve Fritzinger says, how did the economy recover after 1946? Where did new jobs come from? Established firms or new firms? How did the economy absorb 10 million returning troops? Well, Steve, the answer is that these are overwhelmingly new jobs. There was a tremendous restructuring of the economy in 1945-46 because many firms had gone to work producing munitions. About 20% of the labor force had been working in munitions production at the height of World War II, and so a lot of firms had to stop producing these products, whether it was bombing planes or engines for tanks or guns or whatever it was they were producing during the war, and they had to switch over to some form of civilian product. And when they did that, they needed different kinds of labor and all kinds of retooling and what have you. But they did that amazingly well in the sense that resources were switched around on an enormous scale. And while that was going on, the rate of unemployment never rose above 4%. So, that we would love to have a 4% unemployment rate these days. That would be regarded as a superheated economy. But it went from 2% to 4% between 1944 and 46, and that's as bad as it got. So there were a lot of new jobs. In addition, many new firms did start up then. Many people saw opportunities. We need to remember that a lot of technological change had taken place between 1929 and 1945 that had never been applied in civilian production. And so there was a backlog of new technology to be applied in the civilian economy in all kinds of ways. Alex Field, an economic historian at Santa Clara University, has written a couple of interesting articles in the last few years about this. And that is about the fact that a lot of new technology was developed during the Great Depression and during World War II. Many people know about the World War II advances, but of course during the war they were not being applied in ways that were directly applicable to civilian production in most cases, but they could be turned to such uses in many instances from 1946 onward, and they were. So we had new products like television began to be produced, and new kinds of airplanes and what have you, growing out of what had been learned during the war or earlier. Television had been invented back, I think, in 1929. But there had never been television broadcasting until after World War II on a regular basis. So of the 10 million people mustered out in the year and a half after the middle of 1945, about 1 million of them went to school. The GI Bill would make that possible for them. And about 1 million of them became unemployed or left the labor force, and about 8 million of them got jobs, which is astonishing. At the same time, many of the women and older people and younger people who had been holding down jobs during the war left the labor force. So there was also a big switch between job holders in the labor force a la 1944 and the labor force a la 1947. The question from Mike Eisenstein continues, I think, a previous question, or could that never happen due to the intimate relationship between banks and government? And I think I've already spoken to that part of the question, Mike, so I will move on. Joshua Koch says, do you believe anarcho-capitalism is the key to our success as Murray Rothbard has prescribed? Well, as I said earlier, if I had my druthers, I would opt for a system of anarcho-capitalism. I don't think I'm ever going to have my druthers, so anything that I expect to ever see will be something like the system we have now. I think the system doesn't have to be as bad as it is now, and it doesn't have to get worse and worse year after year. There have been occasions when there has been some abandonment. Obviously, this situation I'm discussing about what happened after World War II saw a tremendous abandonment of government control and government employment as a result of the end of the war. Now, that didn't mean that the government's retrenchment was total, as I've argued for a long time. There was a ratchet effect as a result of World War II in a variety of ways. But nonetheless, the government had a more or less command economy in operation during the height of World War II, and it abandoned that kind of economy and went back to something much closer to a market-oriented economy after the war ended. So we can have reversals. We had some partial reversals in the form of deregulation in the late 1970s and early 1980s in transportation, in communications, telecommunications industries, in financial industries. So those things were not unimportant. They didn't change the character of the system, but they helped us move in a way that made the economy work better than it would have if it had retained all of that intervention. So I hope that some of you young people out there will live long enough to see as some of the existing intervention eliminated or reduced in its harmfulness. Timothy Irwin says, do you think this crisis is from poor Keynesian policies only, or is the decline engineered? I don't think the powers that be wanted the decline, Timothy. I don't think they really stand to gain from having economic crises. Obviously, when an economic crisis takes place, there are some people who position themselves in a way that they may actually gain from it, not just political power, but you know, they may eliminate important competitors, for example, through the way government conducts its rescue operations, or they may be able to pocket some of the bailout money, or they may be able to do something else that is beneficial. But by and large, I do not believe that the people who make economic policy are trying to wreck the economy. They do wreck the economy because they don't know what they're doing and because the whole system is so incoherent. The system is responsive to many, many different influential lobbies and influential parties. It's intellectually incoherent and it's policy incoherent because many of these policies that Congress enacts or the president uses executive orders to put into force, these policies respond to some very partial special interest. But at the same time, the government is responding in a countervailing way or in an opposite way to some other very special interest. So the interventionist system is not designed to be counterproductive. It's simply necessarily counterproductive because none of this makes economic sense. It's all the effect of politicians making economic policies for political reasons. And what we get is the result we have. And frankly, sometimes when I think about everything that the government does and has done in the past to intervene in the economy, I'm astonished that the economy works as well as it does. So that's a testimony to the resilience that people display in somehow working around or accommodating or avoiding what the government does. Steve Fritzinger asks, Russ Roberts and others have argued that the CDS and MBS, that is credit default swaps and mortgage-backed securities, would not have existed without Fannie and Freddie's safety net. They couldn't have survived in the wild, so to speak. Did the holding companies and real estate bonds of the 20s have a similar safety net? Well, no, they didn't, Steve. I don't know if I agree with Russ that the credit default swaps and the mortgage-backed securities would not have existed at all without Fannie and Freddie. Obviously, Fannie and Freddie played a big part in the volume of these things that got transacted in the past decade. But I think there might have been possible places for these instruments. They have actually existed in some form before this decade, so of course they may have already been counting on bailouts for the last 30 or 40 years. So Russ's point may still be good, but I think some of these financial instruments that look so dastardly at the moment might have been fine in a different economic environment, but they got caught up in a lot of bad aspects of the past 10 years policy making. In the 1920s, there wasn't anything comparable in terms of people looking to be bailed out. That doesn't mean they didn't go seeking bailouts. Obviously, after 1929, a lot of banks and insurance companies and farm co-ops and other people went to the government looking for for bailouts, even if the government had to create it fresh or recreate it as it did by taking the old War Finance Corporation and giving it the name Reconstruction Finance Corporation in 1932. But the short answer is no, there was nothing comparable as an expectation of bailout behind the holding companies and the real estate bonds of the 1920s. Nicholas Klimchuk has a question. How did changes in productivity over the Depression period affect the non-farm hours worked data that you presented? The answer is that they had some effect, Nicholas. I think because productivity was increasing in the non-farm sector, that meant that employers were even less in the market for hiring new workers during the recovery after 1933. So it did play some role. I think the role it played was quite small compared to the role of cyclical factors. So I wouldn't want to give it a lot of emphasis. This is related to the point I was mentioning earlier about the rapid pace of technological change in the 1930s. Dennis Marburger says, how does the level of total debt, government and private, today compare with that of the 1920s and 30s? I can't give you a quantitative answer to that question, Dennis. All I can say is that the level of debt now is much greater, even in relative terms, relative, say, to the gross domestic product, than it was back in the 20s and 30s. There's been a tremendous growth of debt in the post-war period, and a tremendous growth, particularly of government debt, largely federal, but also at other levels of government, in the past decade alone. So the debt situation is much more leveraged now than it was 80 years ago. Scott Gibb has a question. Do you think the internet, and he gives some applications here, Econ Talk, Fight of the Century, Learn Liberty, Mises Audio, Video, Facebook, will allow enough people to learn about the dangers and weaknesses of government and the virtues of libertarianism before a police state forms? That I can answer already, Scott, because the answer is no, it won't, because there's already a police state in the United States. The question is, at this point, only how much more severe will the U.S. police state become? I've been posting recently at the Beacon, where I put most of my posts, and at some other places, to the effect that we have a horrendous police state in this country at the moment, and I think most people just don't know about it or think about it much because their own homes have never been raided 2 or 3 a.m. at night with flashbang grenades and commandos in black ski masks. That's happened to a great many people, and in the future it's going to happen to more, I believe. Dennis Marburger says, Professor Higgs, is the very existence of aggregate macro statistics and macroeconomics a trap leading to errors and political manipulation? Yes, it is, Dennis. If we didn't have these data, the basis for a great deal of macroeconomic policy mischief would not exist. So it's not by accident that the development of national income accounting and the development of macroeconomics proceeded almost hand in hand in the 1930s and 40s when the decisive changes took place in those areas. And of course, ever since then, the national income and product accounts have been refined and relied on and treated as gospel, and macroeconomics has also been treated as if it were serious intellectual corpus. I think it's just a disgrace to economics. Tony Magrish says, there has been talk by the Republican Party that if given the chance, they would reduce government spending and red tape in the private sector to help stimulate job creation. Do you feel there's any promise to these claims? No, I don't. I think that's hot air. The Republicans have never shown much stomach for carrying through on promises like that. For 50 years, they've been making that kind of promise when they're out of power, which they usually have been. But when they get in power, you see their ardor cools very quickly, and they just don't carry through. When the Reagan administration took office, many people thought Reagan was going to abolish cabinet departments and abolish all kinds of regulations and what have you. What the Reagan administration did was never even in the neighborhood of those expectations. In many ways, it actually made things worse. Dennis Marburger asks, are government actions ever prone to create surprising unintended consequences, as in inflationary policies leading to excessively burdensome debt and overcapacity and a deflationary deleveraging? Yes, Dennis, government actions are constantly creating surprising unintended consequences. That is, I think they come as a surprise and in many cases are unintended by the policymakers. Maybe not to everybody. There's a sense in which many of the things that government does are not mistakes at all, but only represented as mistakes while other people laugh all the way to the bank. But I think we're always forced to choose between, is the government a charlatan or a fool? And the answer is always both. The government is dishonest. It's a charlatan. It doesn't intend to do for us what it promises to do for us. But at the same time, government consists of people who are fools. They don't know how to do what they purport to be doing. They couldn't do it if they really wanted to do it. So letting government into the management of the economy is something like letting a kindly bull into the china shop. The bull probably doesn't have good intentions toward the china shop, but even if he did, it's just in the nature of a bull that he's going to wreak havoc in that place. George Smith asks, what degree of protest was there when Roosevelt issued his order for people to turn in their gold? The answer is that there was some protest, but not very much, George. Some lawsuits were brought, and the thing did drag into 1935 until the Gold Clause cases were decided in favor of the government. But most people just buckled under. In fact, normally when the government tells them to do anything, most people buckle under. Not in the nature of the American people in the modern age to be revolutionary or even very ballsy. They are inclined to frequent black markets. That's usually their way of dealing with things they don't like that the government does, much more than their mounting revolutionary obstructions. Mike Eisenstein says, all the 35 people on this webinar on a Friday evening are enlightened Austrians. With the benefit of our insights on the boom-bust cycle, how do we position ourselves to succeed in this economy? I don't know, Mike. I don't give financial or economic advice because I don't think my advice would be worth anything, and I don't want to mislead somebody. I'm not a fortune teller. I don't know the future. I don't think anybody knows the future. We can always look around and see people who appear to be coping very well, and if we think that's not an accident, we might look to them as models of how we might try to save ourselves. But other than that, I really don't want to give any advice about how people can cope. I have been urging people for some time to leave the United States rather than trying to fight the growing totalitarianism here. but that's another matter, and that's apart from anything one might do to preserve its economic position, although it's not unrelated. Scott Gibbs says, I know you believe America is already a police state, but could you describe how you think the police state is going to change and what libertarians should be doing to counter its growth? Scott, I think that the surveillance the government conducts against all of us is going to become even greater. I believe that more and more permissions will be required for taking even ordinary, currently legal actions. For example, I'm very concerned that the government is going to stop Americans from sending dollars out of the country, as I hope that I will be able to do after I leave this country. But that would have a major effect. I think capital controls may be in our future. Of course, they'll be constructed in a way that allows the big financial players to be exempt or to be accommodated. But this could be a real barrier to smaller fry. So I think surveillance, regulation is increasing. The healthcare system is headed for an eventual complete nationalization. The police state, in terms of the actions of local police, who are now completely militarized, I think will be worse. We now have nothing but armed thugs purporting to be police in this country, and once they get in power, it seems impossible to dislodge them. So I think those are some of the ways in which the police state is going to change for the worse. I really don't think libertarians can do anything about it except try to lay low. And again, if they can, if their personal and family situation permit them to do so, I recommend that they leave this country and go somewhere where prospects are not so bad. Mike asks, all of the 35 people, oops, that's the same question I answered before. It's shown up twice. Okay. Scott Gibb says, why do you call yourself a libertarian anarchist when the term anarchist evokes images of anarchy? What is your definition of libertarian anarchist? And why not call yourself something like voluntarist, which sounds softer and more radical? Well, Scott, I don't think it makes any difference to anybody what I call myself, because I'm not really an evangelist. I don't think anything I say or do is going to change the course of events, and so I'm free to be honest and use the best language I can manage when I talk about things. So I'm happy to call myself a libertarian anarchist, and I know a lot of people don't like that. Even some of the people I work with don't like it and wish I wouldn't do it. But I think, you know, given that it took me over 40 years of adult lifetime to reach this point, I'm entitled to suit myself at this point. Okay, we've still got, let's see, how many questions do we have left? Well, let's see if I can answer the rest of them. Don't ask any new questions now because I'm running way over time. Matthew Gessner says, what were, if any, negative effects of the GI Bill? Well, one negative effect, strange to say, Matthew, was that it made unemployment higher than it otherwise would have been. I already told you it didn't get above 4%, but the fact that you could get unemployment benefit from the GI Bill had the effect at the margin of inducing some people to stay unemployed when otherwise they would have looked for a job. So that was a negative effect from the standpoint of the overall economy. It probably had other negative effects as well. It was a huge subsidy to a lot of colleges and universities when people were allowed at government expense to attend these institutions. And And that was really the beginning of the enormous growth of the higher education sector of the U.S. economy. And eventually, that part of the economy has become grotesquely overblown. It's unfortunate that it's done so. It's very expensive, and it's a misallocation of resources because the great majority of people who are attending college today shouldn't be attending college. They would be better off, and the world would be better off, if those people either got a job and learned things on the job or went out to get a real employment skill somewhere, not in a university. Matthew Gesner says, what were, if any, oh, that's the same question. Okay. So I'll move to the next one, which is Matthew Kisaki says, what role, if any, does or did the underground economy broadly construed play in recovery? Sure, the underground economy is not visible and measurable in the way that the legal economy is, so we're always making educated guesses when we try to determine how big it is and whether it's becoming bigger or smaller. I don't think in either the Great Depression or the current recession there's been enough change in the underground economy to greatly change any of the major movements we see when we look at the legal or measured parts of the economy. Dennis Marburger says, thanks. You're welcome, Dennis. And Josh says, since our time is almost up, I want to salute you. It's been a pleasure. Thank you very much, Josh. Matthew Kisaki says, you suggest we leave the U.S. Where should we go? That really depends on you, your family, your tastes, your skills, your language skills, if any. I have some favorites. Costa Rica is one of my favorites. If you were wealthy, I would say Switzerland is another good place to move. I myself am going to move to Mexico, to a very remote village, and hope for the best. But you know, this all depends on one's personal situation. I think one might be able to do better in many different places. I know Jim Rogers highly recommends that people consider some places in Asia. I don't know anything about how difficult it is to go live and work in Singapore or some other relatively prosperous Asian place, but that's what Jim says. So Jim probably knows a lot more about this matter than I do. Well, very well, ladies and gentlemen. I want to thank you all for being part of the webinar today. I hope you got something out of it, and I know I got something. I got learning by doing, and maybe if I ever do this again, I'll do a better job. So thanks a lot. Bye-bye.